There was once a king of a nation, all right? He was blessed among rulers. When he passed away, there was reverence and honor attached to his name, like no other king had ever achieved before. He was a man of God, and he was said to have a heart after God's own heart. He danced before the Lord, he fought battles in the name of the Lord. He wrote songs and psalms. He praised God in almost everything that he did. And he ruled that special nation, Israel, with a fear and admiration of the Lord that no other king really ever got to. However, there was one day, there was just this one day, when this godly king, whom I'm sure you guys know by now, it's King David, right? He distanced himself from the beloved God that he worshipped. He should have been out fighting with his countrymen, but he was sulking behind in his palace, right? He looked out from his balcony, and he saw the woman bathing on the roof, Bathsheba, right? King David inquired about Bathsheba, found out that she was a married woman, and that should have been the end of it.
I've got a tendency of preaching too long at home.
It wasn't the end of it.
It just happens.
We, of course, knows. We know what happened.
It is good
next.
To be back today. Open with
David
me to Luke chapter 7.
Adultery and murdered Uriah, her husband. Now the question is, what happened there? What happened? Was Bathsheba wrong for bathing on the roof? No. Was David somehow in sin because he looked out and saw her? No. What happened here was that David lusted after Bathsheba, fell to his temptation, resulting in a multitude of horrific things that should have never taken place. This past week, in kind of attempting to figure out what God wanted me to speak about and teach about and everything, there was one theme that kind of kept reoccurring over and over, and it was temptation. The fact of the matter is that we're all depraved human beings in this room. And it's something that we deal with pretty much every day, I would argue. It's an active struggle, and sometimes it feels like your entire day is just consumed with trying not to do something. There was, I believe it was kind of like a little illustration that Lewis Kiger used. He did a lesson sort of on this same topic, I think same verse. And, you know, there was a little boy in the market, right? And there was this vendor who was selling apples and fruit and everything, and this little boy was eyeing the apples, and the vendor turns to him, and he's like, what are you doing, son? Are you trying to steal my apples? And the boy goes, no, sir, I'm trying not to steal your apples. I would never try to force anyone to do this, but I would wager that if we went around the room, and if we were honest with ourselves, everyone in this room probably has at least one act of temptation that they struggle with almost every single day. That one thing probably infuriates you, and when you give in, probably leaves you with a sense of, why did I just do the thing that I really didn't want to do? Why did I do that? And I think it's very easy to get into the mindset of, I just can't do this today. I just can't resist. I have to give in. Maybe you wonder if Satan's power is too strong. It's not unfathomable. We like to rationalize things like that. Other times, maybe you see the lost doing it, and you think to yourself, well, everyone else is doing it. Maybe just this once, it's okay to give in. Maybe you found yourself in the place where you just point blank ask God, do I really have to resist this? I'll be honest. Yeah, I have found myself in these mindsets and questions. This week was one of those weeks. So in this struggle, I approached God's word to kind of see what he says about it, what we can learn about temptation from the word, understand it more. And Christians, I am convinced that we are without excuse when we give in to temptation. It's a great way to start, isn't it? It's encouraging. We need to endure temptation every single day. We need to continue the fight And I'm going to show you why that is and how that is through the text that we're going to go through today. I'm not actually, I don't think we're going to get through everything today. Hopefully, Brother Greg, is it okay if I continue next week? I figured. But we're going to try to get through what we can today. What I want to do is teach you about the nature of temptation, what temptation exactly is, what it means, and how it comes about, what the Bible says about it, and how we can overcome it. Now, this message has some emotionally unsatisfying parts. This is a disclaimer. You're not going to feel great. I didn't feel great. It has encouraging points, but my toes are currently broken right now. I trust and pray, despite that, though, if you stick with me, if you stick with this lesson, when you get through this, you're going to find that the text that we go through isn't just a horrible rebuke, but it's a wonderful, wonderful exhortation. If I could summarize the whole message kind of in one sentence, or one or two sentences, we're going to see that whatever temptations you are currently facing or temptations that you will face, you can bear them, you can endure them, and you can overcome them. You can resist. You can. So with that, let's turn to our text. 1 Corinthians 10:13. That's it. That's the text. I would normally never use just one verse for a text, but you're going to find that this is plenty. This is plenty. And I'm going to do my best to kind of give you the context and the background and the setup. My aim, of course, is to show you how far-reaching this verse is for us in life, but I'm not going to separate the verse from its original context. We can't do that. Since chapter 8, Paul's been talking about how to not hinder the gospel, how to sometimes give up your freedoms and things like that, to do what you can to further the gospel. Sometimes, you know, of course, we have to abstain from things. Sometimes we need to do more things to further the gospel. At the end of chapter 9, he talks about striving for that crown, not wanting to be disqualified. I think it's a very familiar text to a lot of us. And then in the beginning of chapter 10, he develops his thoughts further by mentioning the Israelites who were blessed among nations and had privileges that no one else had. They became overconfident and thought that they couldn't be disqualified, and they became enticed and overtaken with their temptations, particularly idolatry. And then verse 12 gives a stern warning, reminding us that if anyone thinks that they stand and they're impervious to temptation and overconfidence, take heed, because you can fall at any time. Before we get into verse 13, I want to read actually verses 1 through 12 really quick. We're not going to stop and make comments or anything, but I just want to show you kind of this context that's going on here, and I want to show you some of the specific temptations just through the text really quick. So verses 1 through 12. Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye be ignorant, or should be ignorant, how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Now, that's the privilege part. Israel was blessed. But here comes the bad part. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now, all these things happened unto them for ensamples, that is, examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. So, Paul uses Israel as an illustration for how the Corinthians should not be, and then gives verse 13, teaching about the nature of temptation, how it works, and essentially tells the Corinthians they need to resist and that they absolutely can resist. Verse 14 says, wherefore flee idolatry. You can read that for yourself. And it's a confirmation that indeed, blessed as the Corinthians were, keep in mind, they were a gifted church. They were blessed. They needed to resist temptations they were falling into, as opposed to the Israelites who did not resist. And please understand, Corinth was a sinful place. I mean, the other extreme of that is, well, maybe they deserve a slip. I mean, Corinth was a really sinful place. It was so sinful, in fact, that the pagans considered Corinth an immoral place. That's pretty bad. The congregation was surrounded by idolatry and sin everywhere they went, but this did not excuse them, nor did their blessings in their church. So with that, let's read our verse 13, in its entirety. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. All right, let that sink in for a second. I'm going to break this down. We're going to find out exactly what's going on here. Now, it's going to get a little messy. We're going to have to probably readjust our modern definition of temptation. And discerning the meaning is going to be a little tricky. We're going to have to actually look at the Greek. It's our favorite thing, right? But I think it's going to be well worth it. I think you will be well fed from this. I certainly was. I have learned a lot about it. And in trying to understand how to defeat temptation, we must understand the details of how it functions in the Bible. We have to understand our enemy before we can defeat it. And that means cross-referencing. It means doing linguistic checks, things like that. So just hold on. I'm going to try and break it down as simple as I can. But let's get to it. So the first phrase in verse 13 that we need to read and pay attention to is, there hath no temptation taken you. Stop. Now, the very first thing that I want you to note, the phrase is speaking in absolutes. It says, there hath no temptation. We're going to see that play out later, but you need to pay attention to this because this is going to set the tone for the whole verse. There hath no temptation. It's absolute. Paul often leaves breathing room for things, but there is no room for air here. It's sealed tight. Every type of temptation that you can concoct is enveloped here in this phrase. There hath no temptation. Keep that in mind, and we're going to pull that out in a little bit. Now, the next thing we need to do, and this may seem self-evident, but when you start actually doing this, you realize it's a lot more complicated than what we might think initially. We need to actually define temptation. What is temptation? Our modern definition reads, the desire to do something, especially something wrong or unwise. However, what we find when we look at the Greek is just that the biblical usage of temptation here and throughout the New Testament typically comes from the Greek word perasmos, which just means trial or testing. Did you get that? This is crucial for our definition of temptation. Temptation in the New Testament is translated from a word that just means trial or testing. It is a neutral word. Trial in the sense of like an experiment trial, testing. That's the sense of the Greek word that we translate for temptation. It can be used to describe an exterior trial, an exterior test, James 1, 2, James 1, 12. We're going to go there actually in just a little bit. I'm going to show you the different usages of how this word is used. It can also be translated in a sense that describes inward enticement of a person, lusting after sin. Now, that's probably more aligned with the way that we think of temptation modernly. But we cannot forget that there's also this other sense that it's being used in. And we can actually, beyond using James as kind of a language example, like I said, we're going to go there, we can go to James to actually see almost an exposition of how temptation works. So I want to turn over to James really quick, James 1. James 1:12. Actually, really quick, I want to read verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into diverse temptations. Same word used over there in Corinthians that just means trials and testing. Now, I'm going to circle back to this verse in just a second, but jump down to verse 12. Keep verse 2 and 9. Verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Okay. That word again, temptation, same Greek word we find in Corinthians, same one. Due to the context, however, a lot of modern translations will translate in verse 12 and verse 2 to say, blessed is the man that endureth trials, or count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials. Now we can see this because in verses 2 and 12, he talks about temptation in a positive way. You know, count it all joy when you fall into this sort of thing. But then when you get to verse 13, it's all of a sudden kind of a negative thing. The context changes. The word changes based on the context there. Trials here speaks of an exterior testing that's a good thing because it produces patience, things like that. It's a good thing. Now, this could be, you know, a difficult situation. This could be calamity. This could be God seeing if someone would do his will, something like that. And in some ways, I think we're tested, we're tried on the external every single day. But this is not temptation as we think of it modernly. The extreme examples of this, for instance, could be Abraham when he was told to sacrifice Isaac. That is a testing, that is a trial, that is a temptation. He could have responded in a negative way to that. Job is another one. The whole book of Job is him going through a trial, right? A test. Now, sometimes, not because of anything that God does, and of course we're going to read this in a second, not because of anything that God does, but because of our own lusts, these external temptations, that word that just means trial or testing, these trials that God brings about, listen closely, they can turn into inner temptations. They are, this word that we're looking at, temptations, in the Bible, has two sides. It has an external side and it has an internal side. And you can allow the external to become the internal. And that's when you start getting into problems. And that's when you read verses 13 through 15, which we're going to read. So when you let this inner temptation happen, this inner solicitation, you start treading the ground of sin, which is certainly not what James is talking about in verse 2, and it's certainly not what he's talking about in verse 12, contextually. So now let's read verses 13 through 15. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Very different usage of the word. Not a positive thing. Now we're talking about sin and death. We're no longer speaking about an exterior trial. We're not talking about that trial that is on the external, right? We're talking about an inner yearning for what's wrong and what's ungodly. MacArthur calls this inner solicitation, right? An inner solicitation to evil. And essentially what's happening here, brothers and sisters, is that God doesn't tempt people. He doesn't bring about that inner lust you experience whenever you start to entertain the exterior temptation, the trial. When you start to respond in an ungodly way, that is not something that God brings about. He brings about those external trials, yeah. And it can allow for inner temptation, but you have a choice to respond to the trial, the exterior temptation, in the right way. When we lust after something internally, whatever that might be, we carry ourselves to that point, and we choose to respond to the trial by soliciting ourselves to evil. The inner temptation only comes by way of our own lust. So, the yearning is our fault. Entertaining the sin is our fault. So, what's in view here is that, essentially, it's our fault. We can't shift the blame. Begins with the exterior trial. We can respond in one of two ways, the godly or the ungodly. And if it's ungodly, it leads to the inner temptation spoken of here. Let me show you an example of this. Return to David for a moment. Okay? David was presented with an external trial, a temptation, right? He saw the woman bathing on the roof. Now, he could have walked away. There would have been, that was it. He had a choice. He could have saw her. He could have been okay, and he could have just walked away. He could have pushed it out of his mind. He could have gone back and fought with his countrymen where he was probably supposed to be in the first place. He could have done that. He could have even relented pursuit after he figured out that she was married. Now, that was the outward part, right? He could have responded to the God, or to this sovereignly brought about trial that God brought to test him. He could have responded in the good, in the godly way. What God didn't bring about, though, was David's sinful lust and his temptation to press on. That was not of God. That was entirely David. Being tempted externally is not a sin. And if you still don't believe me, Jesus in the wilderness. And how could it be a sin if we're supposed to count it joy when we fall into temptation? Okay, different sense of the word. Entertaining temptation, making it inner temptation and responding in an ungodly way. Yes, sin. Yearning, entertaining desire for sin, lusting after sin, is essentially sin. Wanting to sin is sin. And if you don't believe me, think about when Jesus said, when you look at a woman and lust after her, you've already committed adultery. Now, that specific scenario, it's not really relevant, but the principle of the fact that when you look at someone, a married woman, and you lust, you want to sin, you've already sinned. Once you've let the temptation become internal, you've already sinned. Now, you might be wondering, okay, well, what's an example of a godly response? And Jesus in the wilderness, right? There is no better example than Jesus Christ. God the Father allowed Satan to present Jesus, the Son of God, with three things, each one kind of under the big, I guess, subheadings of sin. We have the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, right? And that was, in effect, the external temptation. Now, the difference, though, between David and Jesus is that Jesus doesn't entertain the temptation. He does not allow it to become an inner solicitation of evil. He quotes the word and turns away from it immediately. There is no even thought about it. He quotes the word and Satan leaves. That's the difference. It is the ultimate model of how we should react to external temptation stimuli. You see the difference there? Jesus didn't sin because he endured the temptation. David sinned because he failed to endure. And again, that leaves us with, one of the crushing major points of my message. Again, it's when we begin to yearn for it, it's our fault. It's not God's fault. It's not Satan's fault. It's our fault. And that's it. It's not encouraging, but it's our fault. We have to be honest with ourselves. It's my fault. It's your fault. We cannot shift the blame, and we must recognize that if it's past that point of external temptation and it's become an internal desire, we only have ourselves to blame. We are allowing it to be there. And it's a hard truth of the matter, but we have to be honest. We have to know what the truth is, right? And I get it. It's not easy. It's really not. You might be thinking, okay, well, that's extremely hard to do, halfway impossible. Sometimes, how do we even prevent that from happening? And I get that. It's difficult. Now, if we turn back to our text in 1 Corinthians, and I'm about out of time, we're going to find that this isn't impossible, and this is kind of how I figured that this lesson would go. We have set up all these things now. We know what we know now. And we're going to find that we can overcome temptation just as Christ did. We don't have to end up like David, okay? And knowing what we know now about temptation, knowing how it functions a little bit, we can see that actually Paul is talking contextually about exterior temptation. He's actually talking about, to the Corinthians, he's admonishing them and in some ways rebuking and correcting them about how to respond to external temptations in the godly way. That is what verse 13 is about. We're going to see that next week. But you're going to see that you can resist. No matter how much you think you can't, you can resist. So we'll go ahead and end there. And then next week, we'll start in verse 13.